All right, well, I suppose we should get going. So, welcome to the last class of this Cosmo exploration that we've gone on. So today I'm going to try and give you a sort of recap, a big picture of inflation, which, we've spent the past 3 weeks learning about. And then I'll tell you about some alternatives. So basically we're going to talk about the challenges to this paradigm. And then, what else there could possibly be out there. And given that it's only an hour, I'll only show you a few other things that are out there and a few of the challenges. But suffice it to say, this is the sort of conversation that's going on right now, actively in researchers that do this stuff. So inflation. All right, let's talk about the good. So why did we invent inflation in the first place? Well, first of all, it's supposed to set the initial conditions for the standard Big Bang cosmology. Namely, it purportedly explains why universe is so homogeneous, why it's spatially flat, and why it is not full of monopoles, or why it wasn't matter dominated from the first place, in other words. Okay, so it provides us this nice set of initial conditions, which, the story goes that you get these initial conditions generically from many, many different initial conditions for inflation itself. We'll question that in a second. And the other thing that we learned that it does for us is that the quantum fluctuations produced during inflation provide a nice description of the seeds of structure. So, namely, these quantum fluctuations are purported to turn into galaxies today. And you get the right spectrum of fluctuations. You get this nice scale invariant, nearly scale invariant, set of fluctuations which can have the right amplitude, et cetera, et cetera. And it's for these two reasons that inflation is a really nice theory of the initial conditions for the standard Big Bang cosmology. It seems to do a lot of work for us. So one thing that I should emphasize is that you should think of inflation more as a paradigm than anything else, right? So when we say inflation, we don't really have a specific model for the scalar field in mind. In fact, there are many consistent models. And Louis touched a little bit on this. Not only are there models with a scalar field undergoing slow roll, there are models that undergo fast roll. There's all sorts of things you can imagine that sort of fit within this inflationary paradigm. Okay. So that's the good. It seems like this paradigm can do a pretty good job of explaining the initial conditions for the standard Big Bang cosmology. But does it? So let's talk about the bad. Okay, so one thing is that there's a certain degree of tuning of the inflaton potential. Say if I had a single scalar field, which had a potential V of phi. So this potential needs to be just right so that we basically need roughly more than 60 E folds of inflation to explain why the universe is homogeneous and isotropic and flat. We need to satisfy the sort of particulars of the spectrum of density perturbations. So it has to have the right amplitude, it has to have the right tilt, et cetera, et cetera. And all of this boils down to a very specific form for the potential. So V of phi needs to satisfy these things, and Why? So why this set of parameters? Why this particular v of phi? Another thing you can note is that typically to get all of these things to happen, v of phi needs to contain coefficients that are small in some sense. So for example, if v of phi was m squared phi squared, then m in units of m Planck has to be roughly 10 to the minus 6 in order to get enough inflation and to have the right properties for the density perturbations, et cetera, et cetera. And if I have a theory of gravity and a scalar field, things kind of like to be of order the fundamental scale in the problem, which is the Planck scale. So why is this 10 to the minus 6? So that's one issue you might have with inflation, is sort of why do I have to pick this really special potential? And another issue you might have with inflation is that there's a certain degree of tuning of the initial conditions for inflation itself. So what we need is, if I have this scalar field, v of phi, I need to start up here. Okay, and a really, sort of very naive, simple objection is, well, why didn't the field start down here? Right? That's where fields like to be, at the bottom of the potential. So why start here? We just had to assume that we started there. We had to assume something else, which was that we start with some initial patch where, if we call this position on the potential phi I, the field was everywhere sort of close to phi I in a spatial region sort of order the horizon size. So I needed to have this fairly smooth initial patch where I had the right conditions for inflation. And once I get that, I get inflation. But why this initial condition again? Why do I have a smooth patch at some time in the past in order to get inflation going? And there's a way of quantifying how bizarre, if you will, this initial condition is by thinking in terms of entropy, right? So if you imagine all the gas in this room, there's a certain quantification for how rare it is to find all the gas up in the corner, which has to do with the fact that the entropy of that configuration of all the gas in the corner is much, much, much lower than all the gas distributed through the room. And there's a sort of concrete way of quantifying that, which we can discuss briefly. So we want to know, sort of quantitatively, how unlikely might this configuration be? How unlikely is it to find the universe in this state? So we can look at entropy. So what do we know about entropy and gravity and/or cosmology? So one of the things we think we know is that black holes carry entropy because they have a temperature, which is the Hawking temperature. And the entropy of a black hole is given roughly by the area of the event horizon divided by 4 times Newton's constant. So if you perform a sort of thermodynamic analogy between gravity and standard thermodynamics, then you'll find that the first law tells you that you should assign an entropy of A over 4g to black holes.
You mean how unlikely are you supporting any gravity, any inclination for first?
So I'm thinking a little bit more qualitatively at the moment. You'll see where I'm going in a second, and then we can get back to details. So a black hole carries entropy, and in some sense, it's the most entropic object that you can imagine, right? So if I take a box of gas and I try and change its entropy by making it more dense at fixed size, so I just keep sticking more particles in, I'm obviously going to increase the entropy of the equilibrium configuration. But eventually, I'll get to a point where I stuff my box so full of gas that it turns into a black hole. And at that point, I can't do anything else, right? It's just a black hole. And I would assign it this entropy. That's sort of the maximum entropy I can think of stuffing inside a box of a given size. And our universe is, in a sense, kind of like a box, because we live in a universe with a cosmological constant, and there's an event horizon. So let's imagine sticking a black hole in our universe where we describe our universe just simply as a De Sitter space, okay? So the metric for a black hole in De Sitter space is just 1 minus 2 gm over r plus h squared r squared dt squared with a minus sign plus the inverse of that dr squared plus r squared d omega squared. So this just looks exactly like the metric for Schwarzschild, but I've got this piece due to the fact that there's a cosmological constant. This is the Schwarzschild De Sitter metric. And this space-time has two horizons, right? There's typically a black hole horizon associated with the black hole. Let's say I make the black hole really small. And then there's a cosmological horizon associated with the fact that I live in a space-time with a cosmological horizon. So in general, there are two horizons. And if I make the black hole really small, then the radius of the black hole event horizon is basically just going to be given by the standard answer, which is 2gm. And the cosmological horizon, we'll call it RC, is basically going to be equal to H inverse, the standard answer. Okay. And as I make black holes of increasing mass, they grow. Okay, and what happens basically is that the cosmological horizon shrinks while the black hole horizon grows. So this black hole grows, and eventually it's going to fill the entire cosmological horizon. And this gives rise to a sort of biggest black hole that I can imagine sticking in a universe that has a cosmological constant. So there is a biggest black hole, and you can estimate the size of the biggest black hole by roughly setting the black hole horizon 2gm equal to the cosmological horizon H inverse. Yeah. Ah, that stands for Schwarzschild De Sitter. Yeah, sorry. So I have this biggest black hole that I can imagine fitting into a De Sitter space. And you can get a sort of order of magnitude estimate of what the radius of the horizon, let's look at the black hole. This is going to be found by roughly GM equals H inverse. Okay, so that means that the mass of this biggest black hole is roughly equal to 1 over, that's totally wrong, 1 over g Newton times times h. So this is the biggest black hole I can imagine fitting into our universe. If I tried to make a black hole bigger than this, well, think about what happens inside of a black hole. There's a singularity. So this would correspond to a universe that undergoes a big crunch, because everywhere is inside the black hole, and inside the black hole there's a singularity. So by making a black hole that's too big, I basically caused the whole universe to crunch. So we can estimate the entropy of this biggest black hole. So that's the most entropic object I could imagine forming in our universe today. So this maximum entropy today is going to roughly be equal to pi, 4 pi, times the radius of the horizon, so the radius of this black hole horizon squared, divided by 4g. Okay, the 4s cancel. This is just the area of a sphere which has the size of the black hole horizon. And we're plugging it in here. We're trying to get area over 4g. So we get pi times the radius of this horizon over g Newton. And the radius of the horizon is, again, roughly given by h inverse. Or we could look at gm. So this maximum entropy, the most entropic thing I can imagine producing, is pi. The entropy associated with it is pi m Planck squared over the value of the Hubble constant today squared. And if you stick in the numbers, this is a number of order 10 to the power 120. So this is an extraordinarily large entropy that I could associate with something that I could build in our universe. Okay, this is basically the biggest entropy I can imagine having in our universe today. The actual entropy today is roughly about 10 to the 90, and that's mostly due to supermassive black holes in the centers of galaxies. The entropy of the photons in the CMB is probably the next biggest contribution. That's roughly 10 to the power 88, I believe, something like that. So this is the entropy we'd associate with our universe today. This you can think of as the asymptotic entropy we'll reach in the far future when there's just dark energy dominating the universe. And we can apply this same logic to find the entropy, the maximally entropic object I could have made during inflation. Because inflation is also approximately described by a universe with a cosmological constant. So S max inflation is again roughly pi times m Planck squared divided by the Hubble scale during inflation squared. And this, well, there's a 1 over m Planck squared in h as well as a v. So this is roughly equal to m Planck to the fourth power over the value of the potential during inflation. So let's say that inflation occurred at an energy scale of roughly the gut scale, 10 to the 16th GeV. That's not unreasonable for a model like m squared phi squared, so chaotic inflation. That would be about what you'd get to get the right spectrum of density perturbations and 60 E folds. So this is roughly, if you work out the numbers, 10 to the 12th. So this is the maximally entropic thing I could have produced during inflation. And you'll notice that 10 to the 12th is a number that is vastly smaller than 10 to the 90, which is a number that's vastly smaller than 10 to the 120. So by these sort of rough arguments, you can see that the timeline of the universe roughly follows the entropy. So I have the entropy during inflation, which is 10 to the 12th. The entropy at the time the CMB was formed is about this number, about 10 to the 88. There's the entropy today, which is roughly 10 to the 90. And then there's the maximal entropy where we'll basically saturate, we think, at about 10 to the 120. So you can see that our universe has a thermodynamic arrow of time, right? So the entropy seems to be continually increasing. And a restatement of this question about how bizarre the initial conditions are can be rephrased as a statement, well, why on earth did the universe start in such a low entropy condition? So if we were to use this gas in the room analogy, this is the early universe. All the gas is in the corner of the room. And so what happens when you let it go? Of course, the gas tries to fill the box. Okay. But bizarrely, somehow all the gas was in the corner of the room. That's a really weird thing to expect to just randomly find, right? And so therefore, you can understand the bizarreness of these initial conditions in the same way that it would be really bizarre out of all the possibilities to find the gas up in the corner of the room. So there's this initial condition problem for inflation. So that's the good, the bad. And now we'll talk about the ugly. So the ugly is eternal inflation. Okay. I personally think it's a rather beautiful idea, but working out the details is extraordinarily ugly. So what does eternal inflation tell us about these problems? Okay. So eternal inflation tells us, well, if I start with some initial condition again, so I do need to specify an initial condition, I will sample many, many different possible histories of the universe, and I'll make this ensemble of different realizations. And effectively, I could imagine sampling different, say, types of inflation in each of these histories. Maybe the inflaton potential looks a little bit different in each. I could imagine sampling a number of different possible initial conditions for each of these individual inflations, if you will. And I realize a whole set of possibilities. These are actually happening somewhere at some time. So you can say we sort of, quote, solve fine-tuning by realizing everything somewhere or some when. But that's a double-edged sword. So I might have the right potential to produce the density perturbations we see today with the right initial conditions for inflation, et cetera, et cetera. But I also have all these other possibilities. And so in order to make this a truly predictive theory, I have to tell you, you know, how likely are all the possibilities . So now I've taken all these parameters. I've said that, you know, in the inflaton potential, I've said that they can take a range of values, so they can be anything. But somehow I need to tell you that the actual thing that we see is in some sense likely, right? I have to predict what we actually see. And in order to contend with that, I really need to contend with assigning probabilities to each of these possibilities. And of course, as I alluded to last time, We're stymied because of this measure problem, which again had to do with the fact that to really make predictions, I have to be able to compare the infinite number of one set of possibilities to the infinite number of another. And that's where we're stuck. And that's the ugly, right? I mean, if we could do this, there would be, in a sense, a solution to all these problems with inflation, but it's really difficult to do this. So another possibility, which I wouldn't really call the good, the bad, or the ugly, but maybe the possible, and this would be, in a sense, I think, a rather beautiful resolution to all these problems, is in quantum cosmology. If there was a principle for the initial conditions that just stated by symmetry or whatever that this is the way that things had to be, then of course, again, we would have solved more or less all of these problems. But of course, we don't have a quantum theory of gravity, so we're more or less stymied. I don't really know what to say about that. I don't know how likely that possibility is, but it's a possibility. Okay, so one thing that you'll notice has been totally lacking from this course is a discussion of the Big Bang itself. Okay, so one rather large elephant we've been hiding in the room is, well, what about the initial singularity? Maybe there's a clue as to the answer there. So actually, we have discussed one case where we contended with a Big Bang of sorts. And that came in the form of these Coleman-DeLucia bubbles. So here's the Penrose diagram for one bubble again. And you'll recall that inside this one bubble, there was this open Robertson-Walker universe where the light cone here is the place where the scale factor of that Robertson-Walker universe goes to zero, which is the Big Bang. So in this model, there is life before the Big Bang. Right, life before the Big Bang, it just means I'm outside the bubble. So that's one sort of resolution of the initial singularity. Of course, the problem here, as you saw during the tutorial, is that you have to impose some initial condition, otherwise you get Olber's paradox. You see an infinite number of bubbles, you wouldn't be here in the first place. And in fact, a sort of another statement of that necessity for a set of initial conditions came from a set of theorems by Borde, Guth, and Vilenkin, which showed that eternal inflation cannot be past eternal. So you really need something to happen there, be it quantum cosmology or a true singularity or a coordinate singularity or something. You have to put something here. You have to make an assumption about the initial conditions in eternal inflation. So there's no past eternal inflation. So that while this bubble model, in a sense, resolved one Big Bang, there's another one. So I don't know if we've really made progress there or if it's just an interesting curiosity. Okay, so how else might we think about the singularity? What other possibilities are there out there? So what if just like the bubble model, there was such a thing as before the Big Bang? How else can I make a model that has a time before the Big Bang? So I'm going to introduce a sort of very simplified model that can also give you a before the Big Bang. So some epoch, some cosmology that doesn't have a singularity. We're going to do this by studying five-dimensional gravity. So just pure five-dimensional gravity. And I'm going to imagine that one of these five dimensions, we'll call it y, is just a line segment. Okay. So I can obtain a line segment by taking a circle, so if y is just the angle along a circle, and I take the circle, cut it in half, and identify the two sides, I'll get a line segment. Yeah? And this kind of identification of points in this dimension is known as an orbifold. Okay? Basically, all that means is I just assume this symmetry. I identify the left side of the circle with the right side of the circle. Okay, that's just terminology. You might see that somewhere else, but it's just words. And let's assume that one line segment, we just put one side at negative y naught and the other side at y naught so that this is y equals zero. And we can write the metric for this five-dimensional space-time as follows. So the metric in five dimensions is just e to the minus square root 2 over 3 phi, where phi is basically a reparameterization of y. Okay. So this is measuring the length of that line segment. So then I have some four-dimensional piece, and I'm going to allow the length of the segment to vary with position in the four dimensions. This is just any metric you like in four dimensions. Times dy squared. Okay. Where all this funny business with the e to the phi's will just be a convenience. So I could have written this as ds4 squared of x plus y naught squared dy squared. But it's going to turn out to be a little bit more convenient to write things this way. Okay, so yeah, phi is related to y naught. So there's no y dependence in the metric, right, in any of these metric coefficients. This thing is a function of x, this thing is a function of x, this thing is a function of x. So I can integrate over y, okay? And since y has a finite length, I don't get infinity. So let's take the action for gravity in five dimensions, which is just m Planck cubed over 2 square root minus g in five dimensions dx5 times the Ricci scalar in five dimensions, and extract out the y. So that's an assumption. In general, I could have that be true. So what it's saying is that for every point in this room, there is an associated other direction that I could be moving. And the size of that other dimension could, in general, vary with space. You could make a different assumption, and you'd get a different metric and a different answer. But for this simple toy model, which I'll show you why it's nice and what you learn from it, this is the assumption. So at this level, it's an assumption. So we can take this this integral, and the reason that this is a nice assumption is because I can now integrate over y, and forget about it. So we're going to keep the m Planck squared over 2 integral. And now I'm going to have the determinant of just the four-dimensional piece times the integral over the four-dimensional coordinates. And I'll extract out this integral over y, where from this metric determinant, I get 4 powers of this e to the negative root 2/3 and 1 power of e to this plus 2/3, square root the whole thing. So here I get e to the minus 2 square root 2 over 3 phi of x. And again, I'm integrating this five-dimensional Ricci. And then there's an m Planck. So all this complicated mumbo jumbo, if I perform this integral over y, what I'll get in the end is the action for four-dimensional gravity plus a massless scalar field. So this five-dimensional picture, if I integrate over y, turns into the theory of four-dimensional gravity and a massless scalar field, where this scalar field corresponds to the size of the extra dimension. Okay, so this is also nice because we know how to contend with gravity plus a massless scalar field, so we can actually make progress solving the full five-dimensional Einstein's equations without having to kill ourselves. So let's assume that that four-dimensional metric is just a four-dimensional cosmology. Again, that's an assumption, and because this is explorations in cosmology and not explorations in black holes, we're going to assume that it's a cosmology. So let's assume that this DS4 is just a Robertson-Walker metric. So this is going to be negative dt squared plus a squared of t dx squared. So that's that piece of the metric. And this is the thing that goes into the action here, the four-dimensional action. So I just have a theory of a scalar field in a Robertson-Walker universe. And of course, we know exactly what we're doing there. So I have equations of motion that look like 3a dot over a equals 0. 0 because this is a massless scalar field. And I have the Friedman equation. So I have a dot over a squared equals phi dot squared over 6 m Planck squared. Okay, so there's just a kinetic energy. And if I make a funny assumption, so let's say t is less than 0 and t equals 0 is again the sort of Big Bang. So I'm measuring time from minus infinity to 0. It's just a choice. I could do that if I want. Then A is A naught, whatever initial condition I choose, negative t to the 1/3 power. And phi, square root 2 over 3, log minus t plus phi naught. So this is an attractor to this set of equations. Actually, you'll explore this a bit in the third problem in your homework in a little bit more detail. So just like inflation, there's an attractor solution, and this is the attractor solution. Okay. So I have this solution, and so I know a of t, and I know phi of t. So I can put that back into my five-dimensional metric and figure out what the full five-dimensional picture looks like. So this five-dimensional metric, if you make these substitutions, is negative t to the minus two-thirds power, and then I've got negative dt squared plus negative t to the positive two-thirds power dx squared. That's the Robertson-Walker part. And then I've got plus negative t to the four-thirds power dy squared. That's just the e to the square root two phi, square root two-thirds phi. Okay, and we can perform a quick change of coordinates to make this metric look like something that we know and love, which is t goes to negative t to the two-thirds power, in which case we can write this metric as just negative dt squared plus t squared dy squared plus dx squared. So this is really simple. This, in fact, is I can identify this piece basically as the Milne patch of Minkowski space. And then I have Minkowski space in the other directions, in these three other directions that I have. So we can draw a picture of this. And then we can interpret what the Big Bang in the four-dimensional picture actually is. So if I'm to draw a sort of Penrose-type diagram, it would look something like this. So now each point on this diagram corresponds to a plane. Okay, so this is just a three-dimensional plane at each point on this diagram. And I'm effectively plotting something conformally related to t and y. It's not exactly t and y, but you have to go through the conformal transformation to stick this into something that fits on the blackboard. And the Milne patch is just these two triangles, where this is negative t down here. The surfaces of big T equals constant look like this. So this is, again, this sort of open Robertson-Walker universe. That's the Milne patch. At this point, little t is 0, which means that a equals 0. So I can identify this point right here as the Big Bang. It's just that point on this diagram. And you'll notice that there's an after the Big Bang. So there's nothing wrong with taking t to be positive. Let me write that in a less confusing way. So up here, little t is positive. And big T is again, just whatever it is. These are the slices of big T equals constant. So in this full higher dimensional picture, the Big Bang is just this point. Okay? And it's not singular. It's just this point on the diagram. So this is a way of resolving the Big Bang singularity from the perspective of, say, a higher dimensional theory. Now, there's a pedestrian example of this, actually, that you might have studied in your general relativity class, where we don't have to introduce extra dimensions or anything like that. I just look at what happens inside of a charged black hole in four dimensions. So that's the Reissner-Nordström black hole. And the Penrose diagram for a Reissner-Nordström black hole looks something like this. Actually, I gotta give myself a bit more space. So the formal solution is this infinite tiling. I have these regions. This corresponds to asymptotically flat space outside the black hole. And then there's two event horizons. There's an outer event horizon and an inner event horizon. And in between these two horizons, the metric actually can be recast in a form that looks a lot like. So in here, ds squared has the form negative dt squared plus a scale factor times dr squared plus r squared times the two sphere. So in here, the surfaces of constant time again kind of look like the Milne slicing. And this piece of the diagram, if I take this piece and this piece, looks a lot like a contracting and then expanding universe. So in the Reissner-Nordström black hole, there's an analog of this. So I have basically an evolution from something that looks like a contracting universe, where T is getting smaller, to an expanding universe where T is getting bigger. And it's in the formal solution, not singular. Of course, this place where I contract and then purportedly go back to an expanding universe has trouble. So here the tiling sort of fails, we think, because the inner horizon is unstable. And that's very easy to understand. Things blue shift in a contracting universe. So the inner horizon of a charged black hole, we expect actually to be a singularity. Effectively, for this reason, if I throw anything into the black hole, then that thing just gets arbitrarily high energies as it approaches that inner event horizon. And there's an analogous problem for this type of cosmology. Okay, so this type of cosmology, while we've written down this nice analytic solution that will take us from a contracting universe to an expanding one, tends to be unstable. So it tends to be unstable for a few different reasons. One of the most serious reasons is the fact that anisotropies in cosmology grow as the universe contracts. So one of the big challenges for cosmologies that have a before the Big Bang is that if I want to take a universe that is contracting and turn it into one that is expanding, before I get there, it will become highly anisotropic. So I guess I should mention these types of cosmology. So if I go from contraction to expansion, usually the event that I go from contraction to expansion is called a bounce. So this is a bouncing universe, but it has absolutely nothing to do with the type of bounce we discussed in quantum mechanics. So not an instanton. So anyway, this is some bouncing cosmology. And a problem for cosmology with a bounce is anisotropies. So we can understand that briefly quantitatively. If I look at a Bianchi type 1 universe, the Bianchi universes are universes that are homogeneous but not isotropic. So what I mean by this is some spacetime that has a metric which resembles the Robertson-Walker metric. So I have a scale factor for x, but then I have a different scale factor for y, and a different scale factor for z. So I just have these generally different three scale factors. So it's still homogeneous, because on any constant time slice, there's no real preferred direction, but it's not isotropic. So if I look at this, you can derive an equation for the average scale factor. So if I define a bar as ax times ay times az to the 1/3 power, it's not really the average, but some product to the 1/3 power. Then this quantity here obeys an equation that's exactly like the Friedmann equation. So the equation for A bar looks something like the Friedmann equation. So I've got A bar dot over A bar squared. And this equals the usual Friedmann term. So I've got rho over 3 and Planck squared, where rho is just matter, radiation, cosmological constants, whatever I want to put into this universe. I've got a curvature term, but then I've also got this term which tells me how the anisotropies grow. Okay, those anisotropies carry energy density in the same sense that curvature can carry energy density. They can come to dominate the sort of energy budget of the universe. Where this is a measure of the initial anisotropy. So that is, how different are ax, ay, az initially? And that difference is going to grow like 1 over a bar to the 6th power. So to remind you, in rho, well, for radiation, rho is proportional to a to the minus 4th power. For matter, rho is proportional to a to the minus 3 power. And so as I go to a equals 0, the curvature term kind of always wins. Okay. Or the anisotropy term, excuse me. So anisotropy grows fastest as a goes to 0. So that means that any universe that undergoes contraction is probably going to end up to be super anisotropic. And it would be difficult to turn that super anisotropic universe, if I reverse things into expansion, into something like we see today. This is kind of the analog of this type of instability in the Reister-Nordström black hole. Things tend to blue shift as you contract the universe. So these anisotropies tend to grow. So that's a challenge, but it's one that can be met sort of by analogy with inflation, by introducing weird enough stuff. Okay, so in inflation, to get an accelerated expansion universe, we had to assume the existence of stuff that does not dilute as the universe expands, which is described by some stuff with an equation of state p equals minus rho. So what kind of weird stuff do I have to assume in order for the anisotropy to not dominate? What we need is what is known as an ekparotic phase in the evolution of the universe. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so no, because it would be fantastically large. And the types of anisotropies we observe today are thought to be more due to primordial inhomogeneities rather than a homogeneous universe that happens to be anisotropic. So the early universe was really highly anisotropic. It would just be totally at odds with what we observe today. Because we want to know what could possibly we have had before a Big Bang. So if we want to consider cosmologies where the Big Bang is not just an arbitrarily introduced initial condition, but actually just one phase in a dynamical evolution, then these are the types of things you have to contend with. Okay, so to get rid of this problem, one way of doing that is to assume this ekpyrotic phase. That's basically, if I think about the equation of state, usually we write it P equals W rho. Rho will redshift like A to the minus 3 times 1 plus W, whatever constant appears in the equation of state. And for a scalar field, W, you'll recall, is just 1 half phi dot squared minus V over 1 half phi dot squared plus V. And through the magic of scalar fields, I can figure out some potential that gives me W such that A redshifts faster than anisotropy. Okay, so the way to do that is to assume that I have some potential V of phi, which is negative V naught e to the minus C phi. So that's something that looks like this, and my field just kind of rolls down this potential, just like inflation. And again, you can solve the equations of motion. This is just, if I assume a homogeneous universe, I just have the Robertson-Walker metric, and I can solve the equations of motion. You'll find A is negative T to the 1/3 power, phi, again, has this attractor solution, which is square root 1 over c squared times the log of negative square root c over 2 v naught times t. And this equation of state, if you plug that into this, is just given by c squared over 3 minus 1. And if I want rho to grow like a to the minus some power bigger than 6, I need c to be bigger than square root 6. And if I assume this, then I have some stuff that tends to dominate the universe as it contracts. So this overwhelms the anisotropy. In the homework, you're also going to calculate the quantum fluctuations that are produced as this field rolls down the hill. And you'll find that they produce a spectrum of density perturbations, which are not scale invariant. Although, if you just had the field and not the metric, it would be scale invariant. This was sort of one of the other reasons why this idea was really popular in the beginning. So you can create scale invariant perturbations by adding another field. And so if I have this contracting universe, which just basically gets smooth, so you can think of this ekpyrotic phase as smoothing the universe because it dominates everything else as the universe contracts, then if somehow I can turn this contraction into an expansion, I'll have a universe that is smooth, homogeneous, isotropic, and filled with density perturbations. Okay. So this is one possible alternative to inflation, although the big challenge here is to again sort of figure out what happens at the singularity. Okay, so I still have to somehow go from a universe that is contracting to a universe that is expanding, and that presently is beyond the sort of state of the art. There are various ideas for that. Since I'm now out of time for this class, I won't unfortunately be able to tell you about those. But there are possible ways of maybe doing that. And this has certainly brought you to the sort of edge of what we really know about early universe cosmology. So with that, I guess I'll let you guys go. So thanks a lot.